He's been running for re-election over the past couple of decades, but those typically came from within his own party. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about the decision by Democratic Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick to run for the Senate seat McCain holds. How strong a candidate could Kirkpatrick be? And how will the dominoes fall to take over Kirkpatrick's House seat? We'll talk about it. Plus, the Nebraska legislature has moved to ban capital punishment in that state, considered one of the most conservative in the U.S. Is it possible Arizona might go in that direction? We'll hear a couple of different opinions. Also, Governor Doug Ducey has announced the members of his classroom's first initiative council. Does that give us a better idea on where the governor stands on K-12 education? And a jingle that Phoenix residents couldn't get out of their heads is remembered by an Arizona Republic reporter. We'll talk about hepatitis and 1980s Phoenix. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. The Tucson Postal Processing Center has gotten a temporary reprieve. The center was scheduled for closure in July as part of the U.S. Postal Service's nationwide consolidation plan. KJZZ's Al Macias reports.
The scheduled closure is the second phase of the consolidation. That would move the processing of packages coming to and from Tucson and letters arriving in Tucson to the Phoenix facility. The Arizona Daily Star reports the Postal Service has extended the timeline originally planned for this summer. The U.S. Postal Service said in an email statement that planned consolidation will resume in 2016. More than 250 employees work at the processing facility. Tucson is one of more than 80 sites to be consolidated as mail volume has declined, according to a Postal Service spokesman. Meanwhile, Southern Arizona congressional representatives are lobbying the Postal Service to keep the Tucson facility open. Al Macias, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The attorney for a U.S. Border Patrol agent who fired shots across the border and killed a Mexican teenager says a lawsuit against his client lacks merit because the boy was in Mexico at the time and wasn't protected by the Constitution. The lawyer argued yesterday in federal court in Tucson during a hearing on his motion to dismiss the civil rights lawsuit against agent Lonnie Swartz.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Carrie Young. The state library is distributing more than $500,000 in grants to 24 county and municipal library systems in Arizona. The money will fund programs for early literacy and tutoring and spaces for science, arts, and math education. Pima County got the largest award for $70,000. Scottsdale and Glendale each received about $65,000.
We're looking for partly sunny to partly cloudy skies today in the valley, a high near 96 degrees. It's going to be 99 tomorrow and 102 on Friday.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Opera, presenting a new season including Carmen, Don Giovanni, and the U.S. premiere of Arizona Lady, a comedy set on a local cattle ranch. Learn more about mini and full season packages and benefits at azopera.org.
Under partly sunny skies, it's 88 degrees in Phoenix at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, Nebraska's legislature has passed a bill to ban capital punishment in that state. And though the governor is acting to quash it, what does it say when a state considered to be conservative moves to abolish the death penalty? And could Arizona be next to move in that direction? Plus, Governor Doug Ducey has announced the members of his classroom's first initiative council. We'll hear from a critic, Arizona Education Association President Andrew Morrill. And a public service announcement on how to prevent spreading hepatitis, including a jingle you just couldn't get out of your head if you lived in the valley in the 1980s. I'll talk with Richard Ruelas of the Arizona Republic, who told the story of the PSA and how it drove two sisters apart. We start today's program with word that U.S. Representative Ann Kirkpatrick has decided to jump into the 2016 Senate race to challenge incumbent John McCain, presuming McCain defeats any GOP primary opponents. So should Democrats be excited about Kirkpatrick? With me now is the chair of the Arizona Democratic Party, Alexis Tamarone. Alexis, good morning.
Good morning.
So what do you think of Ann Kirkpatrick's decision?
Oh, well, you know, I think that Ann Kirkpatrick has a great profile to run for higher office in our state, and I welcome her to the race.
So how strong a candidate can she be? You worked really closely with former Surgeon General Richard Carmona. How does she compare to him?
Well, I think that given the fact that Ann has run some really tough races in Arizona, some of the toughest in the country in comparison to congressional races, that she's battle-tested. She has raised millions upon millions to ensure that she has the resources and the infrastructure and a great staff in order to run those tough races. And I think that's probably where she differs most most from Dr. Carmona. I had the pleasure of running his race a couple of years ago. And Dr. Carmona, for his great profile and background, he had never been in a competitive race the way Ann had. So I think that's where a big difference is between her and Rich, having run those tough races and having won those races before.
Are there certain issues where you think Ann Kirkpatrick has advantages over Senator McCain and other Republicans?
Well, quite frankly, Ann has been boots on the ground in Arizona for many, many years. She has the background as a prosecutor in northern Arizona. She has been a congresswoman, obviously, for the past few years. But she really has dedicated her time and her work to those in her district and across Arizona who need that attention brought to them. You know, I'm right there with Congresswoman Kirkpatrick in honoring and respecting Senator McCain's service to our country and our state. But he's really built up more of a national figure profile. And I think where that is a big difference in the strength where Ann has is that she's really been on the ground fighting for Arizonans every day and has that background in doing so.
Alexis, you made it clear when you took over as chair that you were a fighter. And I wonder, does this indicate Democrats are more willing to put up a fight against McCain? There's been criticism in the past that some of the Democrats that were put up were not exactly folks that had any chance.
Well, I would like to think that, you know, we brought some of that kind of spirit back. But honestly, I commend Ann. I think this shows her dedication to Arizona, that she's willing, even before any sort of Supreme Court decision on our congressional districts, she made the decision to run and run hard from the start. And I think that shows a grit that Ann has. And I know that other candidates have in our party. And it's basically making sure, from my perspective, we have the infrastructure that can support them across the state.
For more than just a couple of days, do you think this energizes the party faithful?
Oh, definitely. I believe so. More than most, obviously, I think that it also energizes folks who have other potential to run, to think about running for the Congressional District 1 seat as well. I think it shows that, you know, in order for to have a big payoff, you have to take risk. And that's what Ann did when she first ran in Congressional District 1. So I think that it shows that it can be done. You have to have a good team behind you, and to have that battle-tested ability to walk in a race is very important. So with that, I hope it does spur even more candidates to take those types of risks moving forward.
Alexis, finally, does Ann Kirkpatrick have a clear path to the nomination, or do you think there might be some other Democrats who jump in?
You know, I'm not sure how large a Democratic primary will be. I do believe that, you know, there's a chance that a couple more, if not one or two candidates, seriously look at this, especially since Ann kind of opened the door for people to take that jump and make that run. So we'll see what happens. And, you know, I'm assuming, too, that a lot of people will make their decisions about their runs, whether it be for Congress or for Senate, or even under some of the statewide seats that we have coming up next year, once we know what's going to happen with redistricting, probably in the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Alexis Tamarone, chair of the Arizona Democratic Party. Alexis, thanks.
Thank you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. With more on what Ann Kirkpatrick's decision to leave the U.S. House and run for the Senate may mean, I turn to Catherine Alonzo, partner at the Phoenix-based strategic firm Javelina. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, so what did you think of Ann Kirkpatrick's announcement and the timing of it?
It was a surprise to me, but Ann has shown herself to be a formidable candidate, and I think that it's, you know, an incredibly exciting thing. And the timing of it was interesting. You know, she is in early, she's in strong, and she's shown herself to be very dedicated to this race.
What do you think of her chances against John McCain? I wonder that Ann Kirkpatrick is in her mid-60s now, certainly a young person relatively when it comes to serving in office. Chances against McCain, and if she were not to win, what do you think her future holds? Could she run for Congress again at some point?
I think Ann has shown herself to be a really tough candidate, really a formidable candidate, and that she is determined, and I think that there's no limit to what she could do in the future, whether she wins this race or not. And so, you know, I think that Anne is going to be a really important part of the future of the state in whatever role that might be. Her, you know, she is really well positioned to run a competitive race. Her district covers nearly half of the state, including 11 counties and 12 Native American tribes. She has a really strong basis for support. And, you know, she is authentically Arizonan. She is from here. She is has a really strong and long record of service for the state. She, you know, she has her own cowboy boots that she wears and she's worn since she was a little girl. It's not staged. She's very real. She's very authentic. And I think that that will speak to voters next year.
I hate to ask the most obvious question there could be, but how much of a factor will money play in this, and how do you think she'll do as far as fundraising goes?
It's always a factor. The money raised and the dark money that comes in from outside groups. She has had a ton of money thrown at her in the past and survived it, and she is a really strong fundraiser. So I think that every indication is that she will be financially very competitive.
As Alexis Tamarone indicated, we're sort of waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide on redistricting, and then we don't know where we go from there necessarily. So going forward, taking that into account, who on the Democratic side interests you as far as potentially taking over for Ann Kirkpatrick or running for that seat in CD1?
What's really interesting is that on both sides of the aisle, there's really a long list of names emerging. And I think running for that district is a big commitment. It's a large district. It's you know, something that people will be looking at really thoroughly, and so I expect in the coming weeks and maybe even months the list will change. And so that, you know, there's all kinds of names being bandied around now, but I think it remains to be seen who will make that commitment and get in.
And the district is an interesting one. It has been since it was created. As you mentioned, it takes up so much of the state, and at the same time it covers rural areas. It covers a reservation. Are there certain things you think that come up that are different issues that people have to run in that district in a different way than they would in other districts?
And that's a good question. I think, you know, it depends really what voters are looking for. I think for a congressional race, a lot of the same issues apply. People want to hear voters' stance on education. They want to hear voters' stance on the economy and jobs and our foreign policy. And there may be, I think that looking at where a candidate is from and how they can best represent and fight for the district are going to be important, but I think that's important in any race, honestly.
Catherine, finally, if this district stays the same, we know about registration numbers, but do you think that one side or the other has an advantage, or is this a true toss-up district?
I think this is a very competitive district, and it just goes to show that the litany of people that are looking at it on both sides of the aisle, that there's a very good chance that this stays a Democratic seat, but I think it's going to be an interesting race.
Catherine Alonzo is partner at the Phoenix-based strategic firm Javelina. Catherine, thanks.
Thank you so much.
So what about John McCain? With millions in his war chest, does he have anything to worry about? With me for a few minutes is Arizona Republic columnist Bob Robb. Bob, good morning.
Good to be with you.
So before the general election even arrives, we know there's a primary. Do you expect John McCain to face a true challenge in that primary, even if it just means he's going to have to exhaust more of his money?
I certainly expect that there will be some kind of a primary challenge. I don't see there being a lot of room to challenge McCain in a primary. I think that he was more vulnerable when J.D. Hayworth challenged him. That was fresher to his litany of sins from the Tea Party conservative perspective. J.D. was a formidable campaigner. And it came up well short. And with the passage of distance and McCain positioning himself as probably the most effective critic of Barack Obama in the country, which is what Tea Party conservatives most want to see, I just don't see there being a lot of room for traction there in the primary.
We've heard the name State Senator Kelly Ward from Lake Havasu. He's making a lot of noise about this. At this point, there are some who consider her to be credible, others don't. But then there are also the names of Representatives David Schweikert and Matt Salmon. Do you have any expectations of one of those two getting in the race?
There's very little in politics at this point in time, Steve, that can surprise me. Either of them doing a kamikaze attack on McCain in a Republican primary in 2016 would be one of those things.
So the answer then, Bob, is it's possible then?
Well, in politics, anything is possible. And certainly there are poll results that would suggest that McCain is vulnerable in both a primary and in a general election. My political instincts are to discount those polls. I just don't see grounds for McCain not being a worthy Republican nominee and not being someone who fits the general election electorate of Arizona.
Is Ann Kirkpatrick, do you think, the best candidate the Democrats could put up at this point? Because one name that came to mind for me, if in fact the Supreme Court rules in a particular way that changes the districts, is this a sort of preemptive strike against Kyrsten Sinema jumping in there?
Well, it's widely speculated, and unlike Sinema, Kirkpatrick hasn't had a pattern of bucking her party on major votes in Congress. So she's kind of stuck running as a run-of-the-mill Democrat in a state that, at least in recent years, has leaned strongly towards Republicans and even conservative Republicans. Sinema would have a far better argument to make based upon her voting record of being more of a maverick, more in keeping with that independent spirit of Arizona. Kirkpatrick is kind of dependent upon her personal story and her cowboy boots make that argument. Her voting pattern has been pretty orthodox Democrat.
Is there any Democrat that would come to mind for you that would make this an interesting race? Richard Carmona, of course, made an interesting race against Jeff Flake, but that was for an open seat.
It would have to be sort of a self-funded surprise newcomer to politics. There's nobody on the Democratic bench that strikes me as capable of giving John McCain a real fight. Now, politics is full of surprises. Every election, there is something that occurs that does surprise me. So it's not impossible, but I think someone coming out of left field, a self-funded, self-made individual who doesn't have a voting record, that can be exploited, I think actually, paradoxically, might have a better shot.
Bob, finally, because of his age and time of service, one may think that having John McCain's seniority in the Senate benefits Arizona. Is that the case, or have times changed? Because there are a lot of people who say, well, McCain is kind of a national senator who just happens to live in Arizona.
Well, certainly, he is a national figure and probably the most prominent national figure in the Republican Party now until there's a presidential nominee. But he's also, with John Kyle leaving the Senate, John McCain has seemed to re-energize and refocus on Arizona issues, and he's been all over the state. I think the Arizona electorate would discount his seniority. We're not a bring-home-the-bacon kind of state. But certainly his chairmanship of the Armed Services Committee will gather him support in certain circles and certain segments of the electorate who would regard that as a very, very important perk to retain.
Arizona Republic columnist Bob Robb, you can read his stuff on Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays in the paper and online probably all the time. Bob, thank you.
Good to be with you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the future of the death penalty in Arizona. And we'll also talk with Andrew Morrill of the Arizona Education Association. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Honor Health. Scottsdale Healthcare and John C. Lincoln are now united under a single name, Honor Health, and are making healthy personal. More information can be found at honorhealth.com.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Stay with us today at 1 for News Hour from the BBC. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now. Fair skies, 68 degrees in Flagstaff. It's cloudy and 70 in Prescott. Sunny, 84 degrees in Casa Grande. Mostly sunny and 87 in Tucson. It's partly sunny and 83 right now in Yuma. A special thank you to our Leadership Society member, Mr. Robert Rosenwald, for his generous support in bringing programs like Morning Edition and Marketplace to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. Right now in Phoenix, with 14% relative humidity, we have partly sunny skies and 88 degrees at 1123.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Nebraska lawmakers passed a bill last week to abolish the death penalty with a veto-proof 32-15 majority. But Governor Pete Ricketts vetoed that bill. At least 30 senators are needed for the veto override scheduled for this afternoon. But the Republican governor has been talking to individual senators to try to keep the death penalty in place. Nebraska has not executed a prisoner since 1997. Could Arizona move in the direction of abolishing capital punishment? With me to talk about that is Elizabeth Ortiz, Executive Director of the Arizona Prosecuting Attorneys Advisory Council. Elizabeth, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to join you today.
It's great to have you with us. So why should capital punishment remain in effect in Arizona, and why should it still be an option for prosecutors? Why is it important?
Well, let me begin by telling you that I bring to you the perspective of not only a career prosecutor, but somebody who continues to prosecute capital cases. So I serve both as executive director of APAC, and I still prosecute capital cases. So I'm in the trenches, I'm working with the victims, and I'm working with the court system. So from my perspective, the death penalty continues to be appropriate and workable for those very, very few individuals who meet the criteria and merit such possible punishment.
In the past, part of the argument was that it acted as a deterrent. Does it, and is that important?
Well, there's a lot of debate as to whether or not it acts as a deterrent. And obviously, you know, given all of the various factors that go into whether or not someone commits a crime, it's impossible to say one thing versus another is an absolute decider. On the other hand, you know, deterrent is a definite possibility, a definite reality. When we, for example, execute somebody in Arizona, we shut down the prisons. So everybody in the prison system knows that an execution is about to happen. The news broadcasts that an execution is about to happen. It is a very big event that all members of our community, whether incarcerated or not, are well aware of. But beyond deterrence, there are many other relevant and appropriate factors for considering continuing the death penalty in Arizona.
I want to go back to what you said. We mentioned victims, and there are many people who feel like the victims' families simply are not thought about enough when it comes to dealing with these cases and the reaction and the pain that they've gone through in subsequent years after a loved one has died at the hands of a murderer. And I wonder, going forward, though, I don't want to make this too emotional, I wonder, but is there a situation in which the victims' families have said to you as a prosecutor in a capital case, do what you have to do, but this is not going to bring back my person, so I'm not really sure that this is worthwhile for us as a family, or it's more important to forgive?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because one of the things that I learned early on as a prosecutor was to be very candid with my victims, regardless of what type of crime we were dealing with, to not give them a fairy tale, to be as realistic as possible, because that helped them prepare and deal with what was to come. So I'm equally upfront when dealing with next of kin in homicide cases. I apologize, Steve. And I will tell you my experience is it is a roller coaster for next of kin. At times they may be very much pushing and encouraging the state to file a death penalty allegation. At times they may rethink that. They may have some moral qualms. So what I tell the victims in my cases, all cases, is their input is extraordinarily important to me. And I will value that, and that will be one factor. But I also make clear to them that not only legally, but just human to human, that responsibility, that final decision is not on their shoulders. So I will listen to them, and I will do my best to do what I think is the right thing in any particular case. But I take that responsibility off their shoulders, because that's just not fair to put it on them.
Elizabeth, one of the reasons this issue has come up again is because of this feeling that as some people have labeled them, botched executions. Others have not labeled it that way. But as a society, do you think we can find a better way that if we are going to keep executions going, a way that takes out this extra sort of show to it, this extra sort of pain, so there isn't that extra cruel and unusual punishment added to the situation?
Well, I can tell you that there is extensive study, extensive discussion, continually reevaluating what is the most effective and appropriate way to carry out executions. So it is there is a science, there is a medical science involved, and I think myself and other prosecutors continue to be open to that discussion. I'm not a doctor. I can't give you a medical opinion on those procedures, but what I will also point out, though, is the examples that we see in the media are often, I believe, taken out of context and really blown, in my opinion, out of proportion as to what actually did or did not happen during that particular procedure.
Finally, Elizabeth, do you expect capital punishment to remain in effect in Arizona going forward?
I do. What we have in Arizona, and I've been a prosecutor since 1993, so I've seen the different. I've seen many changes in capital litigation. I prosecuted before we had Ring, before we had the Ring case where juries were the ones that made the sentencing recommendation regarding death or life in prison. Mm-hmm. So I've seen all those changes, and what I see is that our system continues to refine, continue to focus on that balance between recognizing the appropriate factors for the prosecutor, for the court, for the juries to consider, and also continual and regular protections within that process for the defendant's rights. So I've seen that evolution. It continues to evolve, and I think the system will continue.
Elizabeth Ortiz is Executive Director of the Arizona Prosecuting Attorneys Advisory Council. Elizabeth, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Now joining me is Dan Peitzmeier of the grassroots group Death Penalty Alternatives for Arizona. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Dan, let's start off with the basics. Why do you think Arizona should eliminate capital punishment? Why should the rest of the country eliminate it?
Well, it doesn't serve the common good. It only is revengeful. It doesn't protect society. It doesn't give us what we say it gives us. It's simply a means of revenge.
Is there
society?
Go ahead, please.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you please.
Well, society is, I've never witnessed an execution. I hope never to. But I have attended at least half a dozen, if not more, clemency hearings. And, when we kill somebody like Danny Cook or Mr. King or Robert Towery, we're not making Arizona safer. You know, these people have all been determined to be low-maintenance inmates, down in Florence, and they can do good. They do good. They're a service to society. And, another grave doesn't solve a problem.
Dan, do you think there is a weakness we're showing as human beings then to, in some sense, want to see someone who killed someone we love sort of go through that same sort of suffering?
Oh, I wouldn't know if I'd call it a weakness, Steve. I think it's a very common response. I mean, we're human beings. We're frail. We're fallible. We make mistakes. I had two friends of mine in their 90s who were killed by a home invasion about 3 years ago. And Maricopa County prosecutors chose not to seek the death penalty, which I was grateful for. I mean, they killed an elderly couple. And the two convicts, and both of them had criminal histories, one of them was offered a plea deal, so he went to second-degree murder with, probably out in 20 years, and he testified against the other one on a first-degree murder charge where he was convicted of life without the possibility of parole. But, even though I'm, quote, a pacifist and I'm opposed to capital punishment, I was grateful that Mr. Montgomery and his staff did not seek the death penalty. In my humanity, I wanted to take a baseball bat to these guys who killed my friends. I didn't want to kill them, but, just hurt them.
Yeah.
But, I got over that. But I think the need or the desire for revenge or inflicting pain on others as pain has been inflicted on you is kind of a human trait. you know, and maybe one, you know, as I grow and mature, maybe I'll get over it myself.
But Dan, so what should we do with people who have committed the worst crimes against other human beings for absolutely no reason?
Well, I think we need to lock them up. I think society needs to be protected from them. There are people that don't deserve an opportunity to be in society. But I don't think we need to kill them. I think that's unnecessary. You know, a society, you know, you trust the government who can't necessarily pick up trash on the right day or maintain roads without potholes, and we trust them to take a life. Many, many conservatives, and this is certainly true in Nebraska, who had the Senate vote to abolish capital punishment, conservatives are recognizing that the abolishment of capital punishment is in line with a smaller government. You know, we want a society that you can be opposed to capital punishment from a variety of reasons. Pro-life or religious reasons are among them, and that certainly falls in line with some of the conservative thinking. Mm-hmm. But fiscal is another one. It's very, very expensive to kill someone. What we spent trying to kill Jody Arias is absurd. I mean, if you put somebody in jail for 40 years, which might be life expectancy in prison, at something less than $40,000 a year maintenance, you know, you're coming up with, what, $1.6 million. Mm-hmm. And defense alone on this case exceeded $4 million. And the prosecutorial costs are estimated to be 4.2 times the defense costs. I think the vote in Nebraska is consistent with the growing national trend away from the death penalty. Now, Nebraska hasn't executed anybody in 15 years. They would be among the states that are de facto abolitionist states. I mean, we have 18 states that have abolished capital punishment, and then probably another 15 or 18 that don't practice. There's only a handful of states that execute.
Indeed.
And unfortunately, Arizona is one of them.
Let me jump in, Dan. I want to thank you for your time. Dan Peitzmeier is of the grassroots group Death Penalty Alternatives for Arizona. Certainly a topic we'll revisit. Dan, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Governor Doug Ducey has announced the members of the Classrooms First Initiative Council, which Ducey will co-chair with Jim Swanson, president and CEO of Kitchell Corporation. In a statement, the governor said the council's charge is to develop an education funding formula that recognizes and rewards performance, efficiency, and innovation through flexible distribution of funds for every successful education delivery model. He added the goal is to align funding to student achievement, and with that as the target, shifting the focus to the increased spending in the classroom. The governor also told Capital Media Services last week that he's not willing to raise taxes to increase funding for K-12 education. With me to talk about that is Andrew Morrill, president of the Arizona Education Association. Andrew, what do you think of the people the governor has selected for the Classrooms First Initiative Council?
Well, every governor in recent memory has had some kind of council. Janet Napolitano had the P20 Council, Brewer had the Arizona Ready Council. So in and of itself, a group of education stakeholders to advise the governor on certain matters, it makes sense. You want to look at the makeup of the council. This one does have, of course, a token teacher and a powerful teacher at that, the 2014 Teacher of the Year, Beth Maloney. She's wonderful. But that's the only practicing classroom teacher on this council, and then you have a mix of private interests, voucher interests, representatives from school districts, admittedly. So the next thing to go to is the stated mission of the council, and here's where it gets a little mired in rhetoric, probably more than really addressing real needs. According to the governor, the current financing system we have is antiquated, too complicated for, you know, anyone to possibly understand. And it couldn't possibly address 21st century expectations. So he wants a long-term funding strategy to come out of this group. One wonders then why he doesn't have anybody from the school business officials of the caliber of, say, a Chuck Essigs. I guess there is a representative financial officer, so let's hope that the governor listens to those who really have expertise in what it takes to fund and financially sustain a school district. But look, the truth is, we've got immediate needs right now, crushing needs that the governor could choose to address. A teacher shortage that is probably greater than any documented in Arizona's history, with up to 1,000 positions remaining unfilled late into this school year that's just ending.
Based on what we know about Governor Ducey now, it's only been 5 to 6 months at this point, but do you feel like you know what his philosophy is on public education in Arizona?
Well, I love what the essayist James Baldwin once said. I can't tell you what people think, but I can tell you what they do. Mm-hmm. The governor has chosen to prioritize charter schools that do not stack up in academic accountability nor financial transparency, that educate a bare 13 to 15% of students in Arizona, while our K-12 district system educates better than 83% of students. If this is a pro-choice governor and we are a pro-choice state, why are we not emphasizing and supporting the choice that more than 8 in 10 parents make about educating their students? The governor seems to be playing favorites with the charter school system. Most of his policies, those that he has actually been transparent about, look like they are designed to favor charter schools and charter school expansion. This is a real problem, because what we really need is not charter school expansion in Arizona. We need charter school reform. We need more accountability. We need financial transparency. So we need charter school reform. The governor seems to be more interested in rampant charter expansion.
So based on, as you said, there have been similar councils in the past. Each governor has one. But based on what you've said about the people on the council, the fact that there is that emphasis on charter, should we be actually paying attention to this? Is this going to actually tell us something, or is this just going to be sort of, well, we know where the governor stands, and this just sort of slam dunks that?
The public ignores policy about public education at its peril. Look, we all went through a school system. We all live fairly close to a public school. We rely on public schools to build the future that is going to support all of us in all of our decades. This could be a very good council. There are great people on this council with good connections. There is a variety of political interest, let us say, but the reason for calling this council seems to be a matter of building a new funding system that the governor describes as efficient. Well, this looks like a very long-term, politically mired endeavor. So, yes, of course the public ought to pay attention to this. Then again, the public ought to show up and vote during elections. Yet one never really knows what the public is going to do with an opportunity.
And speaking of elections, there was an election, a special election, when Governor Brewer was in office that created the temporary sales tax increase to pay in part for K-12 education. And then there was Proposition 204, which did not go well in 2012 to make that temporary tax permanent. Now there's been talk about maybe having something on the 2016 ballot that would in some ways raise taxes to pay for public education. Would you generally support that? And are you alarmed that perhaps Governor Ducey is not enthusiastic about that?
Well, I was alarmed when the governor, as a candidate, said, I'm going to drive down taxes in this state as low as I possibly can, because what he's really doing is saying, I'm going to get us as close to bankruptcy as I possibly can. I hope that as a seated governor, he has moderated that position. I hope that he can be informed by very troubling funding trends. We're simply not putting the investment into our schools that we need to. In general, I think that educators will support a funding piece that does not play games, that is to say, doesn't appear to advantage one school system over another, especially a school system such as charters that again, educates a fraction of what our district public schools educate. All publicly funded schools need more revenue, and that includes charter schools, but they should not be advantaged. They have a number of advantages already. So we would probably look with more enthusiasm at a reauthorization of what we have and something that offers more revenue to replace the drastic cuts of these last few years. I think Arizonans would probably support that. They want to know, poll after poll shows, they want to know the money is actually going into their public schools. So we got to meet that bar. I would hope that the governor would reach out and talk to folks and find out what the education community needs really are. But if I'll tell you right now, if we start dumping more rhetoric on increased accountability and increased reform, I'll tell you, we are thick and lavish in accountability and reforms. Arizona has adopted nearly every reform strategy you can think of. By the way, none of them have moved the needle on student achievement. We don't need more reforms and accountability to serve the profiteers and privatizers. Our schools need funding. Arizona families sense this. The governor's popularity has suffered because he hasn't come out and supported that. And he has an opportunity still to lead the effort and say, we're going to do what's right. Brewer did it with a 3-year, 1-cent sales tax. She was a conservative, but she knew that the schools needed the additional assistance.
Andrew Morrill is president of the Arizona Education Association. Andrew, thanks as always.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Morrill responding to the word that Governor Doug Ducey wouldn't support increasing taxes to raise funding for public education. Coming up on Here and Now, we'll talk with Valley resident Andrew Pulsifer, who attracted worldwide attention earlier this month when he posted a photo featuring himself, his wife, and their 3 kids. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, with the highest-ranked MBA in Arizona, according to U.S. News & World Report. MBA Preview Day takes place Thursday, June 4th. Registration at mbapreviewday.com.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us for KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and online at kjzz.org. We should see partly sunny skies in the valley today, a high near 96, and those temperatures are just going to keep climbing for the rest of the week. 99 tomorrow, 102 on Friday, and we may hit 105 degrees on Sunday. NPR's Here and Now is coming up at 12 o'clock today. In the wake of weather-related deaths from storms in Oklahoma, we'll hear about efforts to provide that state's Spanish speakers with more access to severe weather information. And a new Broadway show stars The Big Bang Theory's Jim Parsons playing God. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. It's 88 degrees in Phoenix at 11:45.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. When HIV first began making news to most Americans, assumptions were made about who acquired the virus and how long those people could live. Also, could they have families, or would the virus be passed along in a way that made it simply too risky to even try? Valley resident Andrew Pulsifer, who is HIV positive, attracted worldwide attention earlier this month when he posted a photo featuring himself, his wife, and their 3 kids. Each held up a piece of paper. Andrew's read HIV positive, while the papers the rest of his family was holding read HIV negative. Andrew Pulsifer joins me for a few minutes to talk about that. Andrew, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So you've been HIV positive your whole life. When were you at an age when that became something you thought about?
Probably around like age 11 or 12 when, you know, after my parents had passed away, I grew up with my aunt and uncle. And once I was, you know, able to kind of handle the news around, you know, like fifth grade is when I found out.
What kind of questions did you ask them?
Just, am I going to die? And, you know, and the questions, you know, am I sick? You know, stuff like that. And the questions were kind of unknown, you know. And, of course, my parents gave me the best answers and just said, you know, we're going to put you on some medicine and, you know, we're going to, you know, hope for the best and it'll take care of your body and, you know, you're going to live as long as you can.
You have a beautiful family, as we see in the photo. How long did it take you to feel confident that you could have a family? In fact, tell us about how you and your wife came to have the kids.
Well, we did our first child through fertility treatment because we didn't know. There's so many unknowns with HIV, and there's still studies being done today. And we did our first child through fertility treatment. It took us 3 tries. Of course, it's very expensive. It, you know, wiped out our savings, but, you know, we got a beautiful daughter out of it. And, you know, we did a thing called sperm washing. Well, basically, you give a sample, and then, you know, they wash the semen out, you get the sperm, and then, you know, fertility treatment. And so we did that 3 times. And then for our other 2, we actually had our other 2 naturally, which sounds crazy and sounds risky, but that's the modern world that we're living in. That I don't think a lot of people knew. is that you can, and it's less than 1% chance of my wife getting infected and my children getting infected when we had our other two. And that's just if you are on your medications and you're staying healthy.
Now, your kids are quite young. Do they have any idea about the virus and how it could have affected them or how it affects their daddy?
No, they have no idea. I mean, my oldest is in kindergarten, so, I mean, she has no idea. I mean, literally, when we took the picture, I was like, hey, everyone hold bees, okay, smile, you know. And it was obviously hard, especially for a baby. That baby one is actually Photoshopped because we had someone actually holding that, because trying to put a sign on a baby is really hard to do. So it was, you know, it was fine. And I'll tell them when they're appropriate age, of course, and, you know, explain to them that, you know, I'm healthy, I'm still going to be healthy, still going to be around a really long time.
When did you come up with the idea to do the photo? Why did you think it was important that the world sees this?
Well, because I feel like it really, HIV, whether you look at it or not, it has a really bad vibe and a really negative stigma, so to speak. And so I thought about it over a year ago, and I tried to figure out, man, I wonder if I could, like, you know, tell my, some of my, even my aunts and uncles didn't know. And so my cousins and stuff, and I was like, oh, I got it. You know, I was like, I'm going to do a photo and tell everyone on Facebook, you know, and just, I created an event on Facebook, like, hey, everyone come, you know, I'm going to be revealing something, like, the most important thing in my life, besides being married and having children, like, would you please share my message? And of course it did. And then it went viral after that.
Yeah. Were you surprised by the reaction, or were you heartened by it?
A little bit, you know, I was definitely surprised, because I was like, oh, you know, people were like, oh my gosh, it's spreading and stuff like that. But I don't think it really kicked in until, you know, 12 News is at my door, and it was on BuzzFeed and then Huffington Post. And then after that, I just really couldn't keep track. They just kind of pass it along to the next media source. So
we talked a bit about scientific advances. What specifically has changed about your treatment and how much it affects your everyday life?
Well, it's the modern day, you know, like I take 3 pills once a day, you know, and I'm completely healthy. I'm undetectable, which means when they draw my blood, they can't find any virus in my blood. Like, that's how amazing it is. Of course, it's still there because my body will keep reproducing it. But, you know, it's almost dormant in the white blood cells. And so, you know, basically you can live a normal, healthy life if you stay on your medication, you listen to your doctors and keep your body healthy.
Do you and your wife want to have any more kids?
Not right now. I think we might be done. And people are like, oh my gosh, you know, you're so risky. I still wouldn't do that. You know, and, you know, I think risk should always play a factor. You know, I try to tell people that, you know, I'm like, we all take risks every day. Getting in your car to go to work was a huge risk, you know, and you could have lost your life. Having children is a huge risk, of having a stillborn or something like that. I took the same risk as my family, you know, and I'm trying to also advocate that I'm not advocating that just because you're HIV positive, you know, you can just go out and you won't spread it. You know, I'm like, we always use protection, and we only didn't when we were trying to have children. So I think the world kind of needed to understand that, like, we're trying to be obviously as safe as possible. You know, we know it's there, you know, but, you know, we still wanted to have a family.
Valley resident Andrew Pulsifer, HIV positive. You'll want to see this photo online. It features himself, his wife, and their 3 kids. Andrew, thanks so much for the time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Listening to KJZZ's Here and Now, I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The Valley was struggling with a hepatitis outbreak in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and when officials realized that kids in daycare were bringing the illness home to their parents, some of whom were getting really sick, they decided to act. Naturally, it was determined that a public service announcement with a catchy, some would say annoying jingle could do the trick and limit the spread of the illness. I remember the jingle well as a young boy watching Wallace and Ladmo or old reruns on some summer days, and apparently I wasn't the only one, because Richard Ruelas of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central just wrote an in-depth story about the history of the jingle and a related family feud that's still ongoing. So, Richard, you and I are about the same age, and I remember this jingle really well. I mean, I remember in the summer when I was a little kid, I was watching Wallace and Ladmo. Sometimes even the Dick Van Dyke Show reruns, this would come on. Do you remember it, or did this spark a memory for you when you decided to go ahead and write this piece?
I don't know so much spark a memory, but unearthed it, because this jingle aired so often and so much. Mm-hmm. It aired as you mentioned, on Channel 5 a lot during Wallace and Ladmo, but it was used as a time filler by all the stations. And radio stations, Jonathan Brandmeier, who I spoke to for this story, was the morning show host on KZZP in 81. He made fun of it on the air. So there was a lot of ways to hear this jingle.
And in a moment, we'll get into why it sort of disappeared from the face of the earth. But set the stage for us at the time, based on the research you've done. Why was hepatitis such a big problem in the Valley at that point?
I love that you call it research. But yes, this ended up having me research the epidemic that was going on. And the nearest we can tell, I mean, epidemiologists really can't figure out why hepatitis was such a big problem here, but as close as we can get is that with the advent of working families, two parents out of the house, toddlers who weren't toilet trained were now suddenly in daycare facilities. And with the unappetizing manner in which this disease spreads, that allowed the disease to fester more often because there was unhygienic practices going on along with diaper changes and things like that.
And just like the concept of earworms, the best way to deal with that is to get have someone write a jingle and involve a PSA that gets people sort of thinking about it all the time. Now, there were two sisters you write about. One of them was involved in daycare. The other was a songwriter, at least amateur or whatever at that point. Tell us about how they came together and then how they separated afterwards.
Yeah, Sally Niner ran the Happy Faces Daycare Center. And if you remember the public service announcement, it is the center where the commercial was shot. So she had an outbreak. She had an employee get it, and she thought something needs to be done. She had a sister who had written a song that ended up being fairly popular in the country music circles, and she thought, I'm going to get her to see if she can help write something. A few days later, a song appears called the Hepatitis Song, and she taught it to the kids at the daycare center. And then it gets to the state and county level, and they decide we're going to make this song go viral, I guess, in the terms of the time. So they recorded it in a studio, and then they cut the ad. They filmed the ad at her center, had sort of a chorus of kids sort of lip-syncing it, and it went everywhere. Some of the records I saw. Some of the documents I saw said they were talking about making those little flappy records you would get in a magazine or in the back of a cereal box. They were making those kind of records to distribute it to daycare centers, and the ad, which again was a huge public service announcement at the time. I'm trying to think of what the song would be or what the current commercial that might annoy slash be in our heads, but it's that one. it's that commercial
to your
mind, yeah. that you think, oh, I can't believe they're playing that again. And yes, there it is.
Well, and this is kind of a sad story because these are two sisters who I guess haven't spoken to each other in at least 20 years, right? Mostly because of this.
I spoke with the sisters, and they both told me the backstory. This was part of it, and it might have been the culmination or the focus, depending on which sister is telling the story. And it seems like the big dispute was who actually got credit for writing the song and whether there should have been any money paid out for writing the song. The sister who did write the song, she said she was surprised how often. She came out here on a trip to Phoenix and was surprised to see it on the air so often. And she said she was also kind of surprised that she never saw any cash for it. Now, is there a lot of money to be made in public service announcements? Probably not. An expert I talked to, yes, I even talked to an expert in copyright law, said that most often you'd either donate the song, so you maybe get a tax write-off, or you get a one-time royalty payment, you know, a licensing fee.
And because of that family drama, this conflict, we don't actually have an official copy so that you and I can hum it. I can certainly hum it at some point, but there's no actually real copy of it available publicly, right?
Yeah, I know where one is. it's outside Branson, Missouri, and I asked the woman who ran the daycare center, Sally Niner. She has a copy of the PSA in a box, and it's really stored away. Because of this family drama, she did not want to open it and unearth it. She just said that's too painful. And I let her know, you know, I understand that, and that's part of the story, but you have to understand that there's a lot of people in Phoenix who want to see this ad again. And if there's any way, and I tried to sort of play a little bit of mediation, to say, if we could get a copy of the ad, would you two sisters be okay with us running it, with us seeing it? And we really couldn't get to that point. So the ad's in a box. She didn't want to let us see it. And really, in this time of age where we think, oh, everything's on the internet, this is not on the internet. There are people who have sung cover versions of it, but the actual recording of it, it eludes us.
So, Richard, ultimately, what was the impact of the PSA on the hepatitis crisis? People you talked to, did they say it actually lessened the number of cases or no?
Yes and no. It certainly brought awareness to hepatitis because you and I, as kids, now knew what this disease was and we knew how to prevent it. We knew that if we washed our hands after going to the bathroom and if we washed our hands after changing baby too, that it would lessen the spread of hepatitis and hepatitis would not catch you.
That was done very subtly.
Thank you. But from the records, yes, I looked at records. It did change behavior. The next year, cases plummeted. But Dr. Bob England, who still works for the county at the time, he was a medical student, but he did study the epidemic, that yes, we changed behavior, but you really can't count on, in public health, you can't count on changing behavior to solve a problem. So what actually ended up solving the hepatitis epidemic was vaccinations. They made it so that if you had your kid in daycare, you needed to get vaccinated. That cut out hepatitis. So we really couldn't be trusted to wash our hands after going to the bathroom, as oddly as it seems.
That's alarming. So as a columnist and as a feature reporter for the Republic for a couple of decades now, where does this rank for you? And I don't mean in terms of like if you've talked to a president, but this is kind of fun to go back in time, isn't it?
This is one of the most unusual reporting experiences I've had because I knew that there was a subset of Arizonans, longtime Phoenicians, who would remember this. I also knew that this is a growing, changing metropolis and that there's a lot of people who wouldn't believe that one of the most popular songs in this city, a song that some of us could still sing at the drop of a hat, public performance copyright laws notwithstanding, that it was one of the most popular songs and it was about this odd disease. So, yeah, to be able to try to get to the history of this was a real treat.
Richard Ruelas of the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Richard, thanks.
Thank you.
And remember this. And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on the program, and thank you for listening. If you missed any of our conversations about the legendary hepatitis PSA or capital punishment in Arizona, you can catch them online later this afternoon at KJZZ.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone and follow the program on Twitter at KJZZ Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. NPR's Here and Now is next on member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. It's 12 o'clock.